Whether we like it or not, we are the leaders of the future. To ensure we're well prepared, we need to engage each other in thoughtful conversations to make informed decisions. I'm your host, Akash, and you're listening to A Point of View. Just 150 years ago, cars hadn't yet been invented, and transportation was defined by bicycles, carriages, wagons, and boats. Today, there are over 1.4 billion cars on the road, with an estimated 2 billion hitting the streets by 2035. Accompanying this transition is a structural adjustment in the types of vehicles taking to the streets. Our guest today has worked on autonomous vehicles and is going to share his insights about this burgeoning industry. Kash Pirani is a computer engineering student at the University of Waterloo. He specializes in embedded software and has worked on vehicle technology at Ford, Qualcomm, Cerebras, and NVIDIA. Additionally, he has been the director of the electrical division for Waterloo's student-run autonomous car design team. How do we make the science fiction of driverless vehicles into a reality? Stay tuned for the answer. Thanks for being on the show today, Kash.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking you a little bit about your background. As you know, in Indian culture, there's three different professions you can choose from. You can be a doctor, you can be a lawyer, or you can be an engineer. Why did you choose to be an engineer?
Yeah, so being an engineer definitely makes my parents happy, but believe it or not, that's actually not the first reason why I went into it. See, I've always liked making things, and everyone always tells you about the adage that you should do what you love and it's no longer a job. And in high school and in junior high, I always thought about what it was that made me happy. And it was tinkering with Arduinos, or believe it or not, building IKEA furniture. I thought that was an awesome way to spend my time. And the more I thought about it, I realized what profession gives me the skills to just build anything I want. And that led me to engineering, and more specifically computer engineering, because for me it's always tech I've been interested in. I think that it's really cool when you can build something that has a life of its own. And that's what putting electronics and circuitry and electricity inside a product lets you do. It lets you build a product that, in some sense, has a mind of its own.
And speaking of building, you've had the opportunity to be a part of an organization at Waterloo which was responsible for building an entire autonomous vehicle. We want to explore a little bit how autonomous vehicles are developed and how they come about. But starting perhaps overly simply, what do you see as the primary function of a car or vehicle?
Sure, that's a great question. I think it's somewhat difficult to define what a vehicle is, right? Because we can talk about it as something very, very simple, something that gets you from point A to point B. And in that traditional sense, then a wooden wagon would be a vehicle, or a horse, a living animal, could be a vehicle. But the way we describe vehicles nowadays is a lot more complicated than when the Model T first came out. See, a vehicle nowadays isn't just a set of wheels on a chassis. It's an interconnection and a network of different boards inside your car that all talk to each other. There's actually so much tech and electronics that go into a vehicle, people really don't realize the effort that goes in to make sure everything moves smoothly. For example, if you turn your steering wheel, that doesn't actually make your wheels turn. That just tells circuitry within the car that, hey, I should turn the wheels now. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize. A vehicle nowadays isn't as simple as just moving forward. There's a whole ecosystem of devices that power it.
And when we talk about making that sort of a vehicle autonomous, what does that transition actually look like? What are we changing about the way that, you know, a driver inputs certain commands into the vehicle and changes it to move it forward?
And so in that regards, we sort of talk about the five levels of autonomy for a vehicle. So there's what most people drive nowadays, level zero autonomy, in that it's all manual control. There isn't really anything the car knows how to do by itself. The next step up from that would be level one autonomy. So we talk about driver assistance. So the vehicle can assist in something, so perhaps things like cruise control or adaptive cruise control, but for the most part, the driver is still doing all the work. The car isn't necessarily smart yet. Level two would be partial autonomy. So this is when the car can sort of control its steering and sort of its acceleration. And so if you look at a lot of cars nowadays, they have what's known as lane keep assist. And so if you're starting to deviate from its lane, it'll detect that and it'll then correct the steering for you. Level three is conditional automation. So this is what we're starting to see a lot of nowadays when we're looking at autonomous car companies. So the biggest leap from level two to level three is now the car has its own eyes and ears. It has sensors that allow it to detect the environment around it, and it uses that data to make decisions. So although there is still human assistance required, the car itself is smart in a certain context. Up from there is level 4, and that is high automation. So that essentially means that the car is starting to make its own complicated decisions. So it's capable of steering, braking, acceleration, it can monitor the health of the vehicle, it can turn on a roundabout, it can merge into a highway, and it can kind of drive on the road as you would expect a basic human driver to. Finally, level 5, which I don't think anyone has really realized yet, but what we're all striving for, sort of that Isaac Asimov golden car, is complete automation, which means there is no human assistance required. So you could just sit in the back of your car, not touch any controls, and it, as intelligent or more than a human, would be able to navigate around the city for you.
Google was the first company who announced its self-driving project back in 2009, and was followed by a series of competitors ranging from Lyft to Tesla to Ford, Volkswagen, GM, and others who all hoped to launch this level 5 autonomous vehicle. What is the actual technology that goes into these vehicles that's able to replace the eyes and ears of a human?
So when we start talking about level 3 autonomy, we start to discuss smartness of the car, that it's able to read its surroundings. And there's a couple ways it's able to do this. So first and foremost are cameras. And this is what Tesla is really known for. Tesla is very staunchly adamant that they don't want LiDARs on their car. They believe that with just cameras and radars alone, you're able to build a fully functioning level 4 to level 5 autonomous vehicle. So what cameras let the car do are see things like lane lines, see obstructions in front of it, see the car in front of it, detect weather conditions, detect signage. So if there's a stop sign or a please lower your speed sign, they're able to detect that way. The next sensor that's really useful is radar. And this isn't necessarily the same as you may think, where you have the big circle with all the little blips going on it, the way that you'd see in old war movies when you look at aircrafts. This radar is less omnidirectional and more so directed. So you might have multiple different radars on your car, one that points forward, left, even under the car. And what it tells you is what is in the immediate vicinity. So even when it's really foggy or really rainy and your camera is not able to see things, your radar is still able to ping off of them and detect that. So that allows you to detect things around you that you can't necessarily see, but that you know that are there. And coupled with these are things like ultrasonic sensors, which give you a precise distance from your car to its surroundings. And then very briefly, LiDARs allow you to build a point cloud around you. So the way I like to explain a point cloud is you can think of a LiDAR as a laser mounted on a spinning motor. And so it'll spin that laser around 360 degrees. And that laser will then bounce back off an object, and depending on how long it took for that laser to come back to you, you can tell how far that object is. Now let's say that you're pulsing this laser at a very high frequency while you're spinning it around. What you end up doing is getting a ton of distance values for everything around you. And so you can imagine that it looks almost like when you were a kid and you'd press your hand or face into those metal pin-like toys, and on the other side would come an embossed version of yourself. And that's sort of how LiDAR works. It builds this embossed version of the world around it, where you can kind of see all the distances from all these little points around you. And knowing that, it's like it builds a 3D visualization around the car. And the car, through some very complex algorithms, can interpret that, along with all the other data from its sensors. And you can imagine how if you have all this information and sufficiently powerful compute power and algorithms, that the car can make some very smart decisions.
Right. And despite all that data, we still haven't reached level 5 autonomy yet. So I'm curious as to what some of those hurdles are in reaching full level 5 autonomy, and also why you think companies have repeatedly gone back on their projections, saying that they would have a car by 2019, maybe by 2020. What's going to continue to make these companies push their deadlines when they promised the public that the cars would be fully autonomous by this point?
Right, so there's a lot of things, and part of that is just the intrinsic engineering workflow. So typically when you're looking at a vehicle, you start building it 5 years or so before you want to release it. So let's say that you were going to buy a 2020 Ford F-150. Development on that car most likely started 5 years ago, back in 2015. And as part of that development cycle, there's a lot of iteration going through different international standards to make sure you can build this car, making sure that it's safe, making sure that it meets the right marketing. So it has to be below a certain price for the company to want to sell it. And that's all well and good for the cars that we've been building for the last 50 or so years. But now what happens to all of that if you're trying to build an autonomous car? Suddenly a lot of the old regulations you're trying to build for are tossed out the window, and the international community needs to come together and figure out a new set of regulations for autonomous cars, which standardized organizations like ISO and IEEE are starting to do already. So there's that aspect of it already. The second aspect of it is that this isn't necessarily something that we have ever done before. It's not like it's an iteration on a car, that you're just improving how fast it can go. It's something completely brand new, new functionality, and that takes a lot of research and development. And notice that all of these companies are competitors in the same space. And like every competitive company, of course they're not going to want to share their research with each other. Now, if they were more collaborative and shared their findings, you can imagine that things would accelerate much more quickly. But at the end of the day, they're trying to produce a consumer car. And if you look at some universities, Waterloo and the team I work on included, we have built cars that are achieving quite a high degree of autonomy, almost level 4 at some points. But these cars are clunky, the wiring's messy, and they are ridiculously expensive. To give some insight to that, a LiDAR module might be $30,000 on its own. That's essentially the same price you paid for the car. And so these companies aren't just designing research vehicles, they're designing consumer vehicles. So when you take the constraint of price, making sure it looks good, I don't think anybody wants a big bulbous LiDAR on the top of their car, along with the fact that they're competitive and don't share information, you can see how this research and development process for a brand new technology can take a really long time. And companies always want to market, right? And so they will say that they can achieve something by a certain date, but usually those decisions aren't made by the engineers themselves. That's marketing, press, executives putting that out there. And then 5 years down the line, when the engineers come back and say, hey, we can't do this, then they have to keep pushing that date further and further.
One important part of this process when it comes to research and development is also testing. And so testing to ensure that the vehicles are safe and that the public can feel comfortable riding in a vehicle that perhaps doesn't even have a steering wheel. In this process of testing, what are the things that companies are looking for? And do these tests have to happen on public functioning roads in order to simulate realistic environments?
For sure. So testing can happen in a couple of different ways. When they're first building the autonomous car, there's a few components we need to consider. So first, there are the machine learning algorithms that take the data and make sense of them. So you can think of a machine learning algorithm in a very, very simplified sense as a black box. And inputs come into it and outputs come out of it. And the inner workings of that black box have some weights and configuration values that can be changed. So once you give an input and it spits out an output, you can look at it and say, hey, that output's what we expected, or no, that's not what we expected. And within that black box, it'll turn its gears, try change those values just a little bit, and see if one day it's eventually able to output the right values. So that's called model training. And that's the first way you can test, is testing your models themselves. So without any context of there being a car, if you have a algorithm that is designed to detect pedestrians, then one way you can test it is give it maybe 100,000 photos of pedestrians and see how many of those it correctly identifies. So this is completely outside the context of a car. You just really want to isolate that, hey, can this algorithm detect a person? And once you're confident that maybe it's getting 99,999 out of all of those different images, then maybe you can move forward and say, okay, I think it's fit to put in our car now. The second thing you can consider is what the car sees. So the car itself doesn't necessarily need to be in a real environment in order for us to trick it into thinking that it's seeing things. And this is where the term simulation comes in. So again, the car's sensors are detecting the real world around it. But at the end of the day, what it's really doing is just streaming data into these machine learning algorithms we've already tested. So what's to say that we can't sort of hijack that pipeline and pretend that there is a pedestrian in front of you and stream that exact same data to the car? So to the car itself, it's no different than if it was on an actual road. It's in a dream, per se. And you can say that we're tricking it into thinking it's really driving. And so we build these simulations, almost like video games, for the car to play. And we can see how in these simulations, does the car stay on track? Is it making its turns? Is it going around this roundabout? And this is a really good indication before we even put it on the roads that it's behaving the way we want it to behave. And these simulations can get incredibly complex. In fact, I would say that equal time is spent making the simulator than the car, because you need to be guaranteed your simulator is good for those test results to be meaningful. And finally, like you're saying, once you get government approval, then you can start testing your car on roads. This doesn't necessarily have to be public roads. So there's a lot of private track courses that have been set up for autonomous cars. A lot of campuses, like the University of Michigan, has an entire section of their school designated as an autonomous car test track. That's actually where the SAE Auto Drive Challenge happened last year, where schools from all across the world tested their cars on this very isolated but realistic track. The final step for testing is when you actually do put it on public roads with other people.
So clearly safety is a large priority in not only the testing process, but also in the way that consumers view their vehicles. In Canada, there's roughly 160,000 car accidents each year, with around 3,000 of those car accidents being fatal. One of the big benefits that these autonomous cars could provide is by increasing public safety, but that can often be hindered by public's perception of how, you know, safe they think one of these autonomous cars is. In fact, back in 2018, you had the first death and fatality of a pedestrian who was walking across the street with their bike that occurred as a result of a self-driving and autonomous car. At what point do these companies acknowledge that their vehicles are safe enough, so much so that they'd be comfortable taking the steering wheel right out of the car? And how do they manage perhaps the issues surrounding liability that result from not having a driver responsible for the way the car is being driven?
Right, so I don't think anyone really knows how to make that decision right now, just because level 5 autonomy, in my opinion, is a fairly distant future. I may say 10-15 years plus for full level 5 autonomy. But right now, what people can consider are the cases for level 4 autonomy. So the first thing is that if there's going to be a human driver in the passenger seat, then you are under the same assumption that a human in a regular car is able to make smart decisions and can drive, which is an assumption that we as a society have made, because obviously we have drivers on the road. So there's sort of that safety net there, where there is still a driver in control. The other thing is really just testing. So if you've tested enough and you are fairly confident that you can put this car on the road, then you will. And it's very unfortunate that there have been fatalities as a result of autonomous driving. And like you're saying, that really influences the public perception about whether or not these cars are safe. Because there could be a million of these cars driving perfectly every single day for 10 years. But as long as there's a single car that results in an accident even once, then that flips the whole perception. And we forget about all of the other cars that are doing a good job. One way that I think would be a solution to this is fleet autonomy, which means that if every single car in a community or on a road is autonomous and they're sharing information with each other, then it really takes out that human variable. So every single car knows each other's information and the decisions they're making. At that point, you have a fleet of vehicles that are able to make decisions as a swarm, almost like a beehive. And that can be really interesting when you're talking about traffic jams, because they might be non-existent once you have all cars communicating with each other. And in my opinion, that alleviates a lot of the concerns the public have about autonomous cars making poor decisions. Because if every single car on the road is autonomous, then who is left to make those poor decisions? And of course, it's not as black and white as that, but I think it really is a difficult road to walk down right now when we just don't know what the world is going to look like when level 5 autonomy comes out. So the best we can do is just move up those levels. And for example, just yesterday, Tesla released their level 4 autonomy on their cars for test drivers. And those test drivers are able to go out in their Teslas. They're able to collect data as they're driving around and stream that back to Tesla itself, who's then able to make improvements on their algorithms. How level 5 is going to come about and how we're going to make regulations for that, I think, is a completely different question that most players in the industry just aren't ready to answer.
One final question, Cash. What do you want our audience to know about the future of driving?
The big thing I would say is get excited, because a lot of the content we see about autonomous cars are scary. A lot of it is about why they are bad, about regulations they need, or perhaps fatalities or accidents have occurred as a result of them. And a lot of the perception surrounding the future of driving is that it's inherently just going to be negative. It's going to be dangerous. It's taking the control out of our hands, which is always a scary thought. But I'll say challenge yourself to get excited, because if you take a step back and look at it, these are cars driving themselves. 10 or 20 years ago, this would have been a miracle, right? It is insane to think that we have progressed so far in just the last 15 years that we have companies like Tesla with full level 4 autonomy being rolled out to consumers. And I think, personally, and I think you should think too, that that is insanely cool, that we are quite literally living a science fiction. So of course, be educated, make sure that you know the concerns regarding autonomous cars, but look forward to them too, because it is tremendously cool. And I am more than excited to see what the future holds for driving.
If you've enjoyed today's conversation, you're in luck. In 2 weeks, we'll rejoin Cash and continue our conversation on driverless vehicles, getting more into the implications of the technology and how it will radically transform society. Stay tuned, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.